That's Ethiopian jazz legend Mulatu Astatke with Green Africa. It's from his 2010 album, Steps Ahead. Mulatu Astatke, known as the father of Ethio jazz, is a composer, arranger, and multi-instrumentalist. He was sent to Wales in the 1950s to study engineering, but switched to music instead and graduated from Trinity College of Music in London. In the 1960s, he came to the United States and was the first person from Africa enrolled at Boston's Berklee College of Music, specializing in vibraphone and percussion. In the early 1970s, after collaborating and performing with many U.S. jazz greats, he returned to Ethiopia and introduced Ethio jazz. Mulatu Astatke is still going strong at age 72. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we are on the case again, following the shenanigans at the Clinton Foundation. Today, how $60 million was made to disappear from the books. Our guest, Charles Ortel, a former Wall Street banker and investor who's digging into the financials of General Electric in 2007-2008, proved that the conglomerate had fraudulently overvalued its stock by hundreds of billions of dollars. He's here with us again to detail exclusively major financial and accountability problems with the international philanthropic conglomerate operating as the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. Today, Ortel, who has charged that the foundation is engaging in massive charity fraud, traces the disappearance of $60 million that allegedly was given as a soft political contribution to the foundation during the time that Governor Terry McAuliffe of Virginia, a close friend and political ally of Bill and Hillary Clinton, was a lead member of the foundation's board. As you know, Mr. McAuliffe, Governor McAuliffe, is being investigated by a joint FBI-U.S. Justice Department probe looking into illegal contributions he allegedly accepted through the foundation for his own election campaign. And that, Charles, is where we start today. Take us through this $60 million disappearance.
Great, Eutrice. Thanks for having me back on. When it comes to the books and records of a foundation, these must, in fact, be audited by a competent accounting firm using guidelines and principles that are set forth in very detailed memos that real accountants understand. So to put it in simple terms, what you're doing when you're keeping track of a foundation's books is you're starting at the beginning of a given year, you're looking into how much money went in during the year and how much money went out during the year, and then you're doing a snapshot at the end of the year. And you produce, and you're required to produce, and this foundation was indeed required to produce under the various state and federal and foreign laws that applied to it at the time, a balance sheet as of December 31st, 2003, and a balance sheet as of December 31st, 2004. Now, I won't get into too many details unless you want me to, but there's a simple way of keeping your books that you're not allowed to use for a foundation this size, and that's called cash basis accounting. In other words, you run the foundation as if you were running your house, just looking how much cash is on the kitchen table at the end of every day and not thinking through the liabilities that you have that are going to come due during the year, the assets that you have that are illiquid. You're just looking at cash. You can't do that for a foundation this big. The IRS and other states say it's just strictly not permitted. Yet, that's the way that the Clinton Foundation sort of did their books from inception on October 23, 1997 to December 31st, 2003 or 4, depending on which year you want to concentrate upon. They actually didn't use the cash basis. They used what they call a modified cash basis system. And their own accountants in the work product that was submitted to various states that you cannot find on the Clinton Foundation website because they hide it. They don't put it up there. But I found it, various state online services, flatly states that these books and records are created using a system that is not allowed inside the United States of America. So, you know, the books and records were actually wrong. And the accountants knew it, and the trustees knew it. And the only trustee, or the trustee on the board of the foundation back then, in that crucial year, 2004, with the most experience in understanding accounting was one Terry McAuliffe, who during 2004 was also the chairman, I believe, of the Democrat Party, and very much involved in the campaign. So we begin that year, December 31st, 2003, with a balance sheet that shows at the beginning of the year that it has no debt. And at the end of the year, it shows that it has in the mid-20 million worth of debt. So what that means is that, let's call it 26 million or so, came into the foundation as in the form of cash that then at the end of the year was owed to a bank. They improperly account for that in these hidden financial statements, which I found. There's a $26 million of unexplained cash that disappears. Then they made a donation. The way this works when you set up a presidential foundation, there's an actual law that applies to how you have to do it. And what they said they were going to do was put up a facility in Little Rock and give it all, really, to the National Archives and Records Administration, along with the required cash endowment to support the activities of this thing forevermore. Instead of doing what they originally set out to do, they actually gave a piece of the complex, and it's tough to give away a piece of a building. I mean, how do you allocate common spaces and this and that? They spent, they say, about $165 million or so on the complex, and they gave away, in terms of square footage, 75% of the complex, if that's what they really did. But they took a deduction for only 20% the value of the construction, which on its face makes no sense. Then they called that a non-cash deduction, meaning that, you know, they didn't write a check for that amount. They just entered into a legal agreement, which they argued depressed the value of the facility by $36 million. Well, if you were going to do your books and records correctly, you would reduce your revenues by the $36 million in non-cash. But when you prepared your cash flow statement, you would add back the non-cash expense because no money changed hands. And they didn't do that. So the original way in which they lay all this out is in a footnote in a document that is, again, hidden. Well, the original way is on the website, but they hide the change. The way they explain it differently in a way that makes absolutely no sense. So in sum and substance, there were two moves. One, where they improperly accounted for monies received by borrowing. And two, where they improperly accounted for the way in which they gave a portion of this facility to the National Archives and Records Administration. This is a $60 million problem that is highly material. You know, when you look at these kind of things, people will say, you know, is it a technical glitch? Is it just a small thing? This is not a technical glitch. And the main purpose of this thing was to create a facility in Little Rock and raise money for an endowment and transfer it over to the National Archives and Records Administration. They certainly did not do that properly. They've tried to cover that up ever since. Numerous accountants have gone in. They used a bad bunch of accountants based in Little Rock. One at a firm that still exists called B as a boy, K as a king, D as a dog, BKB. If you Google that firm, you'll see that it has been accused of fraud, basically, and being involved in implicit in fraud in many instances. Then they switched from that firm to the Little Rock office of a very big accounting firm called P as in Price, W, C as in Charles, PwC. And last year, I had extensive interaction via the internet and in the media with PwC, putting them on notice that their books and records were wrong, that this approach was wrong. And the problem here is that if you make a mistake back in 2004 on the largest asset within this thing, it affects every subsequent financial statement. So So all the work that PwC did starting with respect to 2013 or 14 is also wrong, and they knew it was wrong, and they did correct it. Do I have you? Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah,
I'm
sorry.
Telling us that these are basic accounting principles, and you were able, you're not with the IRS, you're not an auditor, but you were able to detect that massive amounts of money went unaccounted for, and the rationales given by the 501c3 organization formed specifically to establish a presidential archive, but it seems to be doing other things outside of its stated purpose. But money is disappearing, and their explanations simply don't suffice. And you're not, you know, you are operating in the same way that you operated when you detected the fraud at GE. You're picking this up right away. What do you think is the reason that an organization in existence since 1997 to this day has not been put on notice by some authority that there are serious questions about its income and its outflow?
Well, I'm speculating, but I do have obviously thought about that. In my experience, people will tolerate small amounts of fraud. You know, I'm just joking around a little bit here, but, you know, somebody puts up an online dating photo that's not exactly of the person, and you have a date and you spend money on it. That's fraud, but people don't really get exercised about it. What I think is the case is that when you deal with very large fraud, you know, the problems at GE, the problems here at the Clinton Foundation, you know, people are not initially prepared to go and say, well, look, you're talking about the former president of the United States. He was there for two terms. His wife is at the Senate, Secretary of State. She might be president. They wouldn't be so silly as to get involved in something that is this criminal. And, you know, so you talk to people. This is what happened. I started on this in February of 2015, having done GE before, having been through, oh, come on, Charles. You know, people, very famous people would tell me, you know, if this is right, then the whole system is crooked. And I said, guess what? The whole system could very well be crooked. And so eventually people focused on GE, and eventually, you know, what I said was proven correct. And similarly here, I can tell you without reporting specifics that, you know, very, very famous people here are finally digging in and seeing what I see. This is not complex math. This is basic arithmetic. This is basic double checking. And it was a very clever thing that people decided to do here, clever in the legal sense. And there are a lot of big names involved. Terry McAuliffe is one name. John Podesta is another, and his brother, who have a, you know, consulting firm. John Podesta is centrally involved in this. He was, you know, he's in the press as having been involved in dealing with scandals, 97, I forget exactly when, or 97, 98, through the end of Bill's last term. He is in a report of a meeting, I believe in November 2011, where the great law firm, the Simpson Thatcher, for some reason included him in this meeting, though he was not a trustee or executive of the Clinton Foundation. He had to know what was going on here. And, you know, both parties have difficulty raising money to fund these very expensive presidential campaigns. So a foundation is, in quotes, perfect. As a vehicle for fraud, you know, especially one that is not really overseen by independent trustees. I mean, you look at who the trustees were of this foundation up until 2013, they are all enthralled to the Clintons, one way or another. You know, Terry McAuliffe was very much involved as the lead trustee from 2000 forward. In fact, when Bill was still in the White House and Hillary, they were dead broke, which they actually were. They couldn't get a mortgage. And it was Terry McAuliffe who put up the cash, according to press accounts, that made it possible for them to buy this mansion. That should have been disclosed in the Clinton Foundation filings, that there was this related party transaction. That's the kind of stuff you're supposed to disclose. Because unlike other foundations where people who have made the money, however you care to say they made it, they have a decided life typically to put money into a foundation. It's their money. They're not out raising money from the public. This foundation, while we're on this radio broadcast, is still raising money on the basis of fairly false and misleading documents that should have been corrected a long time ago, if they can be, and the trustees are grossly negligent, the regulators are grossly negligent, the significant donors who've been, you know, who must have known, Bill Gates' foundation has been giving money to the Clinton Foundation. There's no way that one of the smartest people in the world, Bill Gates and his team, don't know that there are serious problems with the Clinton Foundation. They run one. I've looked through their filings carefully. They have, I think, over 1,000 people working for them around the world. They certainly can afford good accountants and lawyers. They should have checked to see whether all these Clinton foundations were validly organized and operated. Yes, they did, because they have given the Clinton Foundation tens of millions of dollars. So, you know, why would people do this? This is the first family, the first instance, I think, in history where you had, you know, one person go in, lead the charge, be president. And let's just, without going into all the details, let's just concede, I think, amongst friends, that it is clear that the Clintons knew when he was president how to monetize the White House. Those overnight coffee dinners, the coffees, and all that stuff. So they did it once, then Hillary became senator, and then she became secretary of state, and now she's running for president. And the people who buy influence from politicians have in the Clintons a clear-cut example of once they get in, you know, they will take care of you because they have in the past. And so a lot of people who like the U.S. government on their side have rallied behind the Clintons, have given them money, continue to support them. But, you know, this is frankly disgusting behavior. You know, forgetting about the peccadilloes and those types of issues, there are a lot of desperate people around the world. You know, that's not going to change in the next century or the next 1,000 years. It's a massive problem. The infrastructure around the world is not up to snuff. People begin life, 80% of the population begins life destitute around the world. And, you know, here we had a president, and also in the Bush side, you know, former presidents who stood in front of government aid streams in the tens of billions of dollars but did not discharge their responsibility to make sure that this foundation was properly organized in Arkansas, in every U.S. state, in every foreign country. And they went to, we talked about Haiti yesterday. That's just one desperate place where the Clintons got in front of government aid streams. A lot of generous donations from governments, lots from families who probably shouldn't have set the money online into anyway. They should have kept it for themselves. But, you know, in our country, we're very generous, not just the rich. The poor are even more generous, frankly. They shouldn't be giving as much money away as they do. But nonetheless, they do, and they give it with a good heart, hoping to help people. And here the Clintons are running around, you know, not doing the kind of homework they need to do. And it's not just Bill, and it's not just Hillary. It's Dr. Chelsea Clinton. I mean, she has a PhD in health. How come she wasn't looking at this? How come these law firms weren't looking at it? How come the accountants weren't looking at it? And I think the answer is, sadly, that they saw in the Clinton Foundation a business development opportunity, particularly the Clinton Global Initiative, a chance to hobnob with foreign leaders who could unlock valuable concessions around the world, a chance to meet these billionaires. They saw it as business development. And it really, you know, it's been a crooked charity since day one.
I saw a story filed today by Brent Scher of the Free Beacon, and the headline is, Terry McAuliffe has been involved in shady deals with the Chinese for 2 decades. Feds probe whether McAuliffe campaign took illegal contributions from Chinese billionaire. And right there is the beginning of a very suspicious thing. You have a Chinese billionaire, Wang Wenliang, who apparently has had many dealings with the Democratic Party and certainly with the Clintons, promising, I believe, $2 million to the foundation. Now, the way this foundation is organized, it actually is a philanthropic conglomerate. It has several subsidiaries, including subsidiaries overseas. How, from your study of the figures and the financials. How, what story is it telling about the organizational structure of this foundation that it allows its different parts to operate either interdependently or independently?
Well, you know, it's just strictly forbidden. So, I mean, the issue here is that when you go into the law, and I would encourage those who are interested to go to my website, www.charlesortel.com, and look in particular at the so-called first foundation report that I issued on April 20th, 2015. There's several pages in there that give you the important background. The first thing to consider is when you set up a foundation, because there are a public charity, which is what this is called, there are about a million entities like this in the United States, and there are not a million IRS agents, there are not 100,000 IRS agents, there are not even probably 10,000 covering tax-exempt organizations. So they don't have the ability to figure all this stuff out unless they decide to put a SWAT team on it, and they cover that off by having Lois Lerner, who quite frankly is a disgraceful human being based on what's alleged, be in charge of that department. So the Clintons knew, and the people around this entity knew, that it wasn't going to be tagged by the IRS. Whether they had people in the Department of Justice, holdovers who stayed there after January 2001, who knows? Probably they did. They also knew they had allies in key states. You know, take our state here in New York. We have a governor who served in the Clinton cabinet. We have all sorts of problems currently in New York City and New York State with corrupt politicians. We have very high tax rates. So a crooked charity is a very interesting way to launder money and, help out friends and raise money for the expensive campaigns. I mean, this is an expensive media market here in New York, and it happens that other states with high tax rates, like California and Illinois, are expensive media markets, too. So, you know, the business model here, which I guess if you had real investigators, and I am pulling the audience's leg here a little bit just for the heck of it, but this is a case where I would say waterboarding is justified. I would waterboard the people around the Clinton Foundation so we got the truth on what was really happening going back to 1996, 1997, and ask John Podesta and ask his brother and get George Soros and get all these people who have been, you know, washing money to these politicians through foundations to explain their whereabouts, to explain their emails and their alias emails and their phone calls and all of their time from that period forward. And I think if you did that, what you would end up discovering is that, you know, this mess, it's the largest criminal charity scheme ever attempted. And the fact that, you know, I'm pushing on it, I think now it's into the mainstream media. I think I have to tell you that major investigators are looking hard at it now. It won't be long before the big governments look at it. I mean, the UK government has made a £1 billion 20-year pledge to this Swiss organization, which then turned around and gave a majority of its money to the Clinton Foundation to the illegally constructed HIV/AIDS operation starting in 2007. £1 billion. You know, the Australian government has given a tremendous amount of money, over $100 million, I think, U.S. The Norwegian government continues to give money. Various and sundry other governments, the Gates Foundation, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, Fred Eichner, who, you know, strikes me as a decent guy. He runs his own foundation well. You know, I might disagree with his causes and his political leanings, but I look through his paperwork and it's done very well. Save for the problem that he's been giving a material amount of money starting in 2004. To the illegally constructed Chinese operation. So, you know, presidential and political campaigns are expensive to run. Foreign attitudes towards corruption vary around the world. I mean, there are countries, and we don't need to pick on them, but there are countries where corruption is the national sport. You know, it's just accepted. You want something, you pay for it. You pay a politician off. And, you know, the second you allow a president and somebody who might be president to jet around the world unsupervised with trustees that are not independent, with a proven, you know, track record in the past of taking suspicious money, you are inciting a riot, a global riot of fraudsters who will look at this thing and say, you know what, these people are bankable. I mean, you can do business with Hillary Clinton. you can do business with Bill Clinton. And, you know, people will in effect buy protection, they'll buy influence.
We're talking right now about $60 million, but we have in the context to describe it as a mere $60 million, a paltry
right.
$60 million. Given the fact that this foundation has been operational since 1997 until now, and with relatively free rein to do whatever it wants to do under the guise that it's a philanthropic organization, completely ignoring the rules and the law in the way it chose to operate. And we now have a member of its governing board. This was not an advisory board. He was on the governing board of this philanthropy. This is Terry McAuliffe I'm referring to, who is now under federal investigation for a $120,000 contribution to his campaign from this Chinese billionaire. In your estimation, given the volume of money that was funneled through the apparatus, this very intricate apparatus that was constructed, how much money do you think flowed in and out of this foundation in the time that it started until now, from 97 till now?
Well, if you accept their books and records at face value, which I do not, you come up with $2 billion came in and, you know, $1.8 billion went out, rough numbers. 1.7, 1.8 went out. But that's if you believe that only $2 billion was sent towards the Clinton Foundation now, because there's no audit. Nobody's ever checked. Nobody's ever called up these big donors and said, all right, Clinton Foundation says we received 60 from you this year. How much did you really send us? And, you know, please give us confirmation. Give us the wire transfer information. And give us something we can double check. No one has ever done that. So I think the more likely case here is that a lot more money went towards the custody and control of people who are around the Clinton Foundation. Now, the biggest person involved in this mess is a man who spent time in prison called Rajat Gupta, who was worldwide chairman of a very important consulting firm called McKinsey. Now, that's a whole other story, but he wormed his way into, as he was leaving McKinsey, into being the chairman of an organization called the Global Fund. Now, Global Fund was set up in, I believe, Switzerland, as part of association with the World Health Organization, and it was supposed to make sure that all these massive amounts of money that went towards fighting HIV/AIDS and other health causes after George Bush made that historic change in policy where so much more money went into that. I think that was in January of 2003, January 28th, to be precise. I think the U.S. went from sending small money for HIV/AIDS around the world to in the tens of billions. And other countries followed suit, and then there became a concern that too much money was washing around places that didn't have the physical and financial infrastructure to make sure that money would actually go towards its intended purpose. So Rajat Gupta became in charge of that global fund as chairman. And, promptly the system was gamed at the Global Fund to make sure that nobody would really look carefully at what happened. And it wasn't until 2010 that a report came out estimating on the basis of a small sample that somewhere between half and two-thirds of all the money that went into the Global Fund disappeared. So we're talking like, you know, let's call it $50 billion went in and 25 to whatever the math is, over 30 disappeared. A lot of money. Then you have the America India Fund, which was Rajat Gupta created with Bill Clinton starting in January 2001. That happened after a horrible earthquake in Gujarat, India. The books and records are all wrong there. There's never been a valid audit of that entity. And it was a huge embarrassment because it was in 2001, as Rajat was still managing partner with McKinsey, that Enron blew up. And Enron was McKinsey's largest client. And so that was a huge black eye. And in this time frame, it turns out, you know, public records demonstrate that Rajat Gupta had formed a vehicle illegally or in violation of McKinsey policy to take consulting assignments on the side. Not allowed to do that. And he took a bunch of them, and one of them was for a company called Infogroup USA. And that company, the CEO of that company, was a disgraceful operation, was looting the company, take stolen money and giving it to Bill Clinton. And that's in the public domain, starting in 2002. Of course, this information is not on the Clinton Foundation forms. It should be, it was strictly forbidden. And, so the forms are all wrong for that reason. There are other organizations. There's the International AIDS Trust, an invalidly constituted charity. And you go on and on and on. So the problems here, the way the IRS normally deals with these type of problems is your lawyers tell you when you set up a foundation that you may not give money as a gift to another tax-exempt organization that is illegally constructed. You just can't do it. And the IRS really gets tough. The way that Lois Lerner went after the conservatives, that's what they typically do. But so here, the Bill Gates Foundation, big foundation that does good work, was sloppy. Now, why were they sloppy? Who knows? Were they hopeful that maybe the Clintons would help them with antitrust issues in Europe and elsewhere? I don't know. But the facts are that tens of millions of dollars of donations went to the Clinton Foundation from the Gates Foundation at a time when the entities receiving the money were illegally constructed. That's a no-no. Same for the Children's Investment Fund in the U.K., who did this, gave an overwhelming majority of their early grants to this illegally constructed HIV/AIDS operation. Big no-no in UK law, too. So, it's time. I mean, a lot of damage can happen, at least in the for-profit world. People are, cynical about companies and profit-making operations. But the truth is that you can have even more damaging fraud in the non-profit world. Because if you have a charity like this, that's soliciting over the internet, who knows how much money really is going towards the charity? The only way you can know it is if you have scrupulously honest and independent trustees who are numerate, moral, hardworking, understand the law, understand the downsides of running a charity like this in the wrong ways. Instead, I think, when the letters go out, the Clinton Foundation, they're frequently addressed to your supporters. It's almost as if it's a political campaign masquerading as a charity. Well, you're not allowed to do that either. You're not allowed to run the charity as an adjunct to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or any other party.
I want to read an excerpt of the article filed by Brent Scherer today. But before I do, I want to remind the audience that we are having our third conversation, a very illuminating conversation with Charles Ortel, who maintains that the Clinton Foundation is engaging and has been engaging in massive charity fraud. Charles Ortel was the person who, in 2007, 2008, through his own initiative, found that General Electric had been overvaluing its stock. And he blew the whistle on that in 2007-2008, preventing massive, even more massive fraud there, saving investors hundreds of billions of dollars. The article by Brent Scherer of the Free Beacon says, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, who is under federal investigation for a $120,000 contribution his campaign took from a Chinese billionaire, has a two-decades-long history of controversial dealings with China. McAuliffe, who rolled his large network of wealthy businessmen and prolific fundraising ability into a political career for himself, has been criticized for doing inappropriate business with the Chinese since the early days of his career when he was fundraising for Bill Clinton's presidential campaigns. McAuliffe's work with China has been investigated by the Department of Justice before. The DOJ revealed in 1997 it had been investigating whether the Chinese embassy was directing contributions to the Democratic Party in an effort to buy influence in the Clinton administration, according to a Washington Post report. McAuliffe was the man in charge of Clinton's 1996 fundraising operation and was named in a federal corruption lawsuit filed by Judicial Watch that alleged that he was involved in the scheme. McAuliffe was the architect of the Clinton fundraising strategy that brought big campaign donors into the White House to get them energized for the 1996 reelection effort. He wrote the infamous Lincoln Bedroom Memo, which outlined how donors could pay their way into the White House for events such as having coffee with the president. So this particular board member, brought on by the Clinton Foundation, not only was an intimate, a political intimate of both Bill and Hillary Clinton, but also was a marked man in the sense that he was under investigation and, as the headline says, involved in shady deals with the Chinese for two decades. Are there any red flags when philanthropies of this type or at this level are constituted, that some entity asks for proper vetting of its governing board?
There are major red flags. I mean, if you, as I have done, if you go state by state, and each U.S. state has a slightly different tradition of charity law, but you read through the cautionary memos that typically an attorney general's office will have written and are available online. There's one here in New York called Right from the Start. It will dissuade anybody who has assets from being a trustee. You're supposed to take your responsibilities super seriously. You are not allowed to operate a charity as a political activity. You are not allowed to profit from operating a charity. You are not allowed as an insider to get to appropriate a profit through the operation of a charity. You're just not allowed to do it. It's not even a close call. And, you know, the charity should be, the tax-exempt authority of a public charity is a very valuable thing, and the government expects you to run it in the interests of the charity, not in your personal interest, not in your business interest, not in your political interest, but to protect the integrity of the charity. And if you run a charity this way without audit, flagrantly, in disregard of the law, who knows what their board minutes state? No related party transaction disclosures. What you're doing, and I hope to do here, is to use this Clinton Foundation Charity Fraud Network as a bold case study that will go through the ages and help people over the rest of time, so long as there are charities, to understand how you should not run a charity. So we can say, you don't want to pull a Clinton here. You don't want to do this, because look what happens when you do a Clinton. There has to be an expose of this. There has to be one from the inside. You know, it can't simply be the trustees tasked to fix this. The trustees are grossly negligent, all of them. The Clintons themselves and every other one of them has for some reason or another, and if it's most likely a bad reason, they haven't risen to the task of facing down the Clintons. Now, there is one man, actually, who may cover himself in glory, and he is now at Yale, where I went to college, Eric Braverman. He was brought in to fix this mess. He tried, and under unexplained circumstances, which is a red flag, actually, Utrecht, he left in January, I believe it was, 2015. He's somebody who really needs to be deposed. There's a woman called Anita Batt, B-H-A-T-T. She needs to be deposed. There are a number of people around us who know what really happened, and they all need to be deposed under serious, serious penalties. A further thing I should mention that folks may not understand well, and surprised me when I learned about it, is that when you operate a U.S. charity internationally, there's special rules. The IRS is very suspicious about U.S. charities operating abroad, and foreign governments, naturally, are also suspicious. You know, is it the charity or a front? So the rules have evolved and are quite strict, and you must control the foreign operations of a charity from a U.S. base strictly. So there better be some good evidence that happened. And what I can see in the public domain is that these charities internationally are completely out of control. And right there, that's a bright line violation. So why did the Obama administration let this happen? So clearly they have their own people. This is a highly visible charity. President Obama himself made, unfortunately for him, a $200,000 donation to the Haiti charity in 2010. And that charity was illegally constructed, illegally operated, as we have discussed. And, you know, the IRS, if it were a normal person looking at this, they would go in and they would revoke the charter of that entity. And they would say to President Obama and his wife, sorry, you know, the $200,000 deduction you took on your taxes, you owe us that money back with penalties and interest.
Are charities allowed essentially to operate as parallel structures to corporates, a corporate structure where they have subsidiaries that, again, are either quasi-autonomous or wholly autonomous? I'm thinking that this is, I don't know for sure, but you will correct me if I'm off base here. It would seem to me that a charity that has a stated purpose, even if it establishes other related entities, would be exactly like that. They would be related with regard to the stated purpose of the original charity. But here we have all different kinds of charities that are operating as subsidiaries, or which is basically to say they're following a corporate model here. And it seems as if they say, well, because it is a subsidiary of the original charity, which was to essentially establish a presidential library, that everything associated with it, even if it is a separate entity, falls under that the aegis of the original intent. So is this what they have been using to successfully evade detection?
Well, let me correct a few of those statements. You're not allowed to do any of what you just said. What you have to do is you file for your first charity, the presidential library, you file an application, and the IRS makes it clear in the application and through what's happened over time that you cannot lie on the application. You've got to tell the truth about your own background, any defects in your background, your capabilities, your objectives, and you've got to lay it all out in the application. What the IRS does, if they find after the fact that you've made a material misstatement, they will go back, generally, and they will say, all right, in the application you said this and it wasn't true. I'm sorry, what we have to do now is revoke your charter back to that date. That's the first issue. Second issue is that in the annual operating reports that you file with the IRS, which are called Forms 990, and they have schedules attached to them, there are specific questions you have to answer. Did you change the nature of your operation materially? But please list out all the related taxable and tax-exempt organizations with which any officer, director, or significant person has a relationship. Because unless you do that, you're not going to be able to figure out these related party transactions. Well, the Clinton Foundation never did that. Never did that properly. You also have to list out all your foreign offices and foreign bank accounts. They may have listed some out, but that's the kind of thing the FBI needs to get its hands on ASAP. There are these very strict forms that or regimen of reporting that was tightened after September 11, 2001, because a lot of these radical terror groups use charities as false fronts, the Holy Land Terror Foundation and all that. So they created this regimen where if you have foreign bank accounts, you got to list them out to the IRS. And the Clinton Foundation was required, all of these entities were required, to file these forms, which were due, because most of these charities have a December 31 fiscal year end, they were due by June 30th of the subsequent year. You have to list out all your foreign bank accounts, and you can't group them together, and you got to list out every single one and everybody who has any authority over them, their high balance, their low balance, their average balance, their starting balance, their ending balance, and it's really onerous stuff. And, you know, once the FBI gets that, and gets the real list of all the organizations and reconstructs the history of this thing, you will have some hope of figuring out how much money they have been fed here or there to the Clinton Foundation. Now, one other complication is that when you operate internationally, of course, many countries have different currencies that don't trade at par with the dollar. So if you run a charity as this has been run out of control, you can fudge your results. You can make them look like whatever you want, because typically the currency exchange rates move a lot during the year. So you can invent invoices, you can invent exchange rates, you can make it really, really complicated so that people won't have the patience to figure it out. And you asked earlier, you know, are there warning signs for this kind of activity? Believe it or not, accountants write memos about that. There's one that I excerpted in on my site, www.charlesortel.com, where I list out portions of a memo called Considerations of Fraud in Financial Statement Reporting. And they specifically highlight numerous things that any experienced accountant who wanted to keep his or her job should have spotted a long time ago. It's not rocket science. It's obvious stuff. If you're operating internationally in corrupt countries, transporting high-value things like HIV/AIDS medicines that are small in bulk, fungible things, you know, you've got currency fluctuations, you have repeated restatements, which they do, repeated management changes, a lack of independence of the board. These are all signs where a typical accountant might look at this and say, you know, actually, I don't want the assignment. You know, it's too messy.
Well, we also have the angle here of a lot of foreign diplomatic connections. And this, too, should raise a series of red flags, because under the guise that this charity is global in scope, it's doing business literally all over the world, it's interfacing with foreign governments, it is taking advantage of the fact that the head of the foundation involves a former president, a former secretary of state who is also now a presidential candidate who also was in the U.S. Senate. The implications here are enormous about how, under the shield, a protective shield of philanthropy, they were doing things that normally would require a whole different regimen in order to qualify to interface with foreign governments. How did they manage to do that?
Well, you know, that's, I hope we'll find out. You know, what I think you learn, or we will learn, is that there are certain very valuable choke points in the government. So one of them is, we talked about it, I believe, yesterday, this idea of the deputy chief of protocol is the person who is in the Secretary of State's responsible for, I believe, most interactions that top officials have with foreign government leaders. So these various delegations that, you know, the Secretary of State president may lead abroad, the one that President Obama's on now, the Secretary of State's going to have a lot of say about who goes, travels with the president, who is in what meetings abroad in which of these countries. And GE, I think, just signed a big agreement with one or more foreign countries selling things, different arms dealers. You know, if they're traveling with the president, you know, that's an enormous boost to your ability to market inside these foreign nations. On the other side, the foreign leaders that want to come here with their own delegations, they have to get screened by the Secretary of State's office. So that deputy chief of protocol is a very important person. This Dennis Chang guy, who was a young guy, and you know, I've got nothing against young people going into positions of great power, but you know, they better have a moral compass. They better understand what the rules are. They better understand that this is the United States of America. It is not a country where you have lesser standards of ethics. And the list, the email list, and the telephone list, and the other list, and the knowledge that he would have had about the various visitors here and travelers abroad is enormously valuable. Did he leave that in the Secretary of State's office, or did he communicate using the personal server? Who else was in touch with that valuable list on the personal server? And maybe an alias email. I mean, this is just, the people I have spoken to who have served in high positions of power are aghast at the basic notion that you would even try to conduct business other than using an official .gov address. Here they've had this private server system. How long have they had it? You know, Iron Magaziner, who's a close associate of Hillary and Bill Clinton, is an expert on this kind of stuff. He was, in fact, the Internet czar for President Clinton after he screwed up with Hillary the health care reform effort. So, I mean, he has a long history of top associations around the world with high-tech stuff. He ran it and runs a consulting operation. Now, what role has he been playing in the private server and people around, you know, the other consultants to the private server? Why would you even conceive of doing this? And no, it's not the case. The prior secretaries of state have used all and conducted all of their official business on a private server. Nobody did that.
So, if you were to guess, to what degree does the Clinton Foundation and all these shenanigans associated with it represent a kind of movement within the world of politics to monetize political influence and to monetize political office, where because you've been president of the United States, because you've been a U.S. senator, because you are a presidential candidate, these things can pay off if you manage them very carefully as a full-fledged enterprise. Now, in some parts of the judicial world, this would pretty much constitute racketeering and conspiracy, Corrupt Organizations Act type things. RICO statutes would be invoked. It is amazing to me that we don't see this kind of discussion related to the Clintons at all. Yet, everything that I've been reading about the Clintons and how they've been functioning, how they've been able to transform political office into an extraordinarily lucrative career, lucrative enterprises using political influence, it begs two questions. How typical has this have they been, or are they, in this transition where political influence is made to pay off in an organized way by constructing these kinds of entities? And two, are the federal laws adequate in terms of addressing these kinds of things?
Well, those are great questions, Eutrice. First of all, I'll deal with the adequacy of laws. The answer is obviously not. If they were, this wouldn't have happened in the first place. Now, on the question of, and I think you need here, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of creating global bureaucracies, but here you may need one. So that's one set of issues. The second is that, you know, when you see how these presidents travel, and I'll give you a little vignette. I like to stay in a hotel in London. It's called Claridge's. It's a very nice hotel. And I was there years ago, for an extended period, when the president of Colombia, the country, was visiting the UK, and he had numerous death threats on his head. He traveled to Claridge's, to the UK. I believe he had 3 bodyguards. Another time, after H.W. lost in 92, I was in Stockholm at the Grand Hotel, another nice hotel, on business, and I looked out, and I was told, I knew the owner of the hotel, and I was told I had the only room in the hotel, because the entire hotel had been taken over by the departing Secretary of State, who was attending some boondoggle conference. You know, why do you need to travel with that many people? So what happens is these presidents, you know, they're hangers-on. They get used to traveling in gigantic jets, gas-guzzling, climate change-affecting jets and fleets of motorcades and big suites and all this kind of stuff. And they can't do what Harry Truman did at the end of his presidency, you know, get in the car and drive back to Missouri and try to look for a job. I mean, that's beneath them. You know, they've got to continue the lifestyle.
Gone are those days. I want to thank you so much, Charles, for being with us today and giving us yet more information. And we should follow this because you're doing extraordinary work. You're posting what you've discovered and you're posting the supporting documents on your website, charlesortel.com. You can go there and look for the information yourself and you can make sense of it yourself. But I want to thank you so much for your patient exploration keeping pace with my slowness here to understand and comprehend the complications here. But you've done a marvelous job of keeping pace with me. Thank you so much for being with us. And we look forward again to you coming back and giving us more information about this unfolding story.
Anytime you choose. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That brings us to the end of our program today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, NDC Savings Club. You want to stay tuned for that. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking of these programs and what you're learning as a result of listening to these programs. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. We see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.